This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello and welcome to Democracy North, a Canadian and global independent news and culture hour featuring the top interviews and headlines from this week's daily media morning show at w2media.ca. On this week's show, we're excited to profile some of the big issues going on across Canada, including an interview with freshly Juno-nominated band A Tribe Called Red as they embark on a cross-country tour. We'll hear about their Juno nomination as well as the philosophy behind their unique mix of music, which has been dubbed Powwow Step. We'll play their feature chat about their work. Also, Dr. Monica Dutt, chair of Canadian Doctors for Medicare, responds to the federal budget, calling it significant cuts when it comes to health care. And finally, Jahan Zabhousain interviews two Toronto activists who are bringing attention to civilian deaths in Afghanistan using sports. As well, we'll cover all the local, national, and international news headlines. Stay tuned. First, though, we'll come back with our headlines.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independent like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.com.
I'll be right back with this week's top news headlines. In our top story this week, across the country on Friday, women and their allies will be marching for over 824 missing and murdered Aboriginal women. The marches are part of Women's Memorial Marches for Missing and Murdered that happen every February 14th across the country for the last 21 years. The numbers, however, are now documented to be at least 824, but calls for a public inquiry into the high number of missing and murdered Indigenous women who are grossly outnumbered when it comes to uninvestigated cases and unsolved cases remain unheeded by the Harper government. As Aboriginal People's Television Network reports, the government unveiled Tuesday a budget that makes no mention of an inquiry, but commits $25 million over 5 years beginning in 2015 to continue efforts to reduce violence against Aboriginal women and girls. The money will be a continuation of the same amount of funds pledged in 2010, however, raising many criticisms that the government continues to refuse to do an inquiry into the matter. In BC, despite a heavily criticized online process, approximately 2,000 individuals, groups, and governments registered to the deadline to apply to participate in the National Energy Board's hearing into the Kinder Morgan Oil Sands Pipeline Expansion Project. The Vancouver Observer reports that the Trans Mountain Pipeline would carry nearly 900,000 barrels per day of diluted bitumen from Alberta's oil sands to Burnaby through densely populated areas, including near drinking source aquifers, homes, and playgrounds. As an NEB spokesperson said, on Wednesday, the large number of applicants was considerable but expected. The huge list includes many governments, including 15 cities from Vancouver, Surrey, Burnaby, Chilliwack, Abbotsford, Kamloops, and Edmonton, the province of Alberta, Nicola Tribal Councillor, and many other First Nations, as well as golf courses and businesses concerned about the impact on their lands. Another applicant to the process was Suncor Energy, the largest oil sands company in Canada. The Alberta energy giant is expected to speak in favor of the project. It wants to transport its oil to customers via three new Burrard Inlet docks that would be built, including hundreds of supertankers a year, increasing fivefold in numbers, shipping the fuels to Asia and beyond. Over to Quebec, where Montreal Main and Atlantic Railway has been the subject, in fact, of repeated infraction notices prior to its devastating tragedy in Lac-Mégantic that destroyed the small town's downtown core and killed 47 residents. But the CBC has learned that it had been violating rules around securing trains for years, and yet Transport Canada never imposed any sanctions on the company. The CBC reports those violations, documented in Transport Canada files, were noted several times from 2004 until 2012. Just what happened on the night of early last July, when an MMNA train rolled down an incline, derailed, and exploded in the core of Lac-Mégantic, continues to be under investigation. But the use of the handbrakes and how the train was secured are at the heart of the inquiry and have been since its early days. In the weeks following the disaster, the Transportation Safety Board said its investigation found the braking force applied was not enough to hold the train on the 1.2% descending slope where it was parked overnight. The documents obtained by CBC show at least eight warnings were issued to MMNA by Transport Canada between 2004 and 2012. Concerning that particular section regarding brakes, section 112 of the Canadian Railway Operating Codes. It adds to growing outrage against the railway, which has declared bankruptcy. However, it had been exempted from having two conductors on board by the federal government prior to the accident. In federal news, the minister in charge of a new controversial Elections Act said this week that the government is now open to changing a provision that experts feared would prevent the chief electoral officer from speaking openly. According to the National Post, Pierre Poilievre, the Minister of State for Democratic Reform, said in an interview that he would be open to amending the bill if the language needs to be clarified to give Marc Mayrand, the chief electoral officer, some comfort. In an interview on CBC Radio, Mayrand said, "I cannot no longer speak about democracy in this country. I'm not aware of any electoral bodies around the world who cannot talk about democracy." Until Monday, however, Poilievre had declined to clarify whether the act was designed to prevent the head of Elections Canada from giving media interviews, for instance. The act was, as prevented, said the electoral officer may provide the public with information on the following topics only, listing only details of locations and times to vote. Stephen Harper's government has imposed many restrictions on the ability of public servants and scientists to communicate directly with the public, insisting that messages, even from an arm's-length organizations like the RCMP, must be pre-approved by political staff in the Prime Minister's office. Lawyers who reviewed the Elections Act said the clause in question appeared designed to restrict the right of Elections Canada to speak in a similar way. Poilievre finally clarified. However, in a question period on Monday, NDP leader Tom Mulcair accused the Conservatives of using the clause to cover up elections wrongdoing. What hasn't changed in the Act is a ban on Elections Canada promoting voting to groups underrepresented in the polls, including Aboriginal people and young adults, as well as ending the ability for those without proper identification to be vouched for by another voter, both of which some critics say amounts to suppressing the non-conservative vote. In whaling news, nations that continue to do whaling, seemingly against international treaties, Iceland and Japan, are using Canada as a transshipment destination in the trade of meat from endangered fin whales that they claim are being captured for scientific research. This is the same species that Canada has agreed internationally to protect. But according to the Vancouver Sun, Canada says it is now helpless to stop the trade in whales, even though it is a signatory to the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species and Wild Fauna and Flora. In 1981, it listed the fin and other endangered whales under its Appendix 1, the highest level of protection against commercial trade. Iceland and Japan are also signatories to the convention, but did not agree to the 1981 listing, which means they are legally permitted to trade in the whales' meat and even use Canada as a transshipment destination. In Toronto, a transgender woman who had been detained by immigration in a men-only jail was denied release Wednesday and is now set to be removed from Canada. Avery Edison, 25, was held at the Maplehurst Correctional Complex in Milton for 20 hours. After her story spread online, sparked by her tweeting of her initial detention at Pearson International Airport, she was transferred Tuesday night to nearby Vanier Center for Women. Edison was deemed inadmissible to Canada when the British comedian arrived at Pearson on Monday from her native England. The authorities said she was being deported because she had overstayed her visa on a previous visit here. At a closed-door detention hearing Wednesday, Immigration and Refugee Board member Valerie Curry denied Edison's release because the adjudicator didn't believe she was planning to leave and would appear for her flight. The transgender woman from the UK was stopped at customs at Pearson Airport for overstaying a previous visa. She was then detained in a men's jail before being transferred to a women's facility. Avery Edison identifies legally in her British ID and passport as female, but was sent to Milton's Maplehurst Correctional Complex, a facility for high-risk violent male inmates. In Venezuela, at least four people have been killed, including a police officer, a pro-government social movement leader, and several other protesters against the government, after thousands of Venezuelans opposing President Nicolas Maduro took to the streets of Caracas following 2 weeks of anti- and pro-government protests across the country. As Al Jazeera reports, gunfire erupted in the center of the capital when armed members of a pro-government vigilante group arrived on motorcycles and began firing at more than 100 anti-Maduro student protesters. One protester was shot in the head. Also killed, however, was the leader of a pro-government 23rd of January collective who support Venezuela's government, and Luis Ortega confirmed that a police officer was also killed by anti-government demonstrators. It is the largest set of protests since Maduro was elected nearly a year ago following the death of his mentor, Hugo Chavez. Pro-government supporters countered with a march of their own, expressing support for Maduro, who has accused his opponents of trying to violently oust him from power just 2 months after his landslide victory in mayoral elections. Across town, Maduro told his supporters they would not back down in the face of what he said was a conspiracy by opponents fueled by international support from the United States to provoke violence and destabilize his government. In Pakistan, a Pakistani court has ordered the country's intelligence agencies to produce a prominent anti-drone campaigner who was abducted last week by February 20th, or to categorically state they are not holding him. According to Al Jazeera, the head of Karim Khan's legal team called Khan's abduction from his home late on February 5th a signature government abduction. Alleging that Pakistan's powerful intelligence agencies were responsible for the disappearance, Khan had been due to fly to Europe on the 15th on a trip that would see him testify before members of the European Parliament in Brussels against the U.S.'s use of drone strikes in Pakistan's tribal areas that have killed thousands of civilians. Khan's 17-year-old son and brother were both killed in a drone strike in Machikel area in North Waziristan in 2009. Since then, he has waged a legal battle against the United States, going as far as to name the then CIA chief in Pakistan in a lawsuit he filed in Islamabad High Court. That case is ongoing. In Palestine and Israel, Jerusalem's planning committee moved forward on Wednesday with plans to build a 9-story Jewish seminary in the heart of a densely populated Palestinian neighborhood. Agence France-Presse reports that plans for the new tower block to be built in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of annexed Arab East Jerusalem were deposited for consultation, giving the public 60 days to submit objections. According to this settlement watchdog Peace Now, the area is a Palestinian residential neighborhood located in the north of the Old City, home to 2,700 Palestinians, including well-known landmarks such as the Orient House, the American Colony Hotel, and the Palestinian National Theater. It has many consular missions. It is an area considered of strategic importance, and settlement groups have made persistent efforts to take control of its land from Palestinians. Israel captured East Jerusalem during the Six-Day War in 1967 and later annexed it in a move never recognized by the international community, including Canada. It considers all of Jerusalem its internal indivisible capital and does not see construction of the eastern sector as a settlement building. However, Palestinians west of Jerusalem want the capital as their promised state, which is currently being discussed in U.S.-led negotiations with Israel, currently struggling to make headway ahead of an April deadline. Both Palestinians and the international community consider all Israeli construction of land seized in 1967 to be a violation of international law. In Central African Republic, Amnesty International, the UK-based rights organization, has said that anti-Balaka fighters in the north of the country are trying to ethnically cleanse Muslims, citing first-hand testimonies from victims of the violence in the country. According to Al Jazeera, the result of the violent attacks, quote, is a Muslim exodus of historic proportions. According to Amnesty International, has criticized the international community's response to the crisis, noting that peacekeeping troops have been reluctant to challenge the mostly Christian fighters and have been slow to protect the Muslim minority. France has sent 1,600 troops to its former colony, in addition to nearly 6,000 peacekeepers from African nations. And finally, the mass surveillance carried out by the U.S. National Security Agency means that governance of the Internet has yet to be made more international and less dominated by America, according to the European Union. As The Guardian reports, the decision from the European Union came after a worldwide day of action against NSA surveillance of people's online and phone activities. Meanwhile, the European Commission called for a shift away from the California-based Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, which is subject to U.S. law and contracted by the government empowered to supervise how digital traffic operates. And that's our news for this week. Be right back with an interview with Canadian doctors for Medicare to hear about how the budget may impact your health care.
The 2014-15 federal budget contains the largest annual spending cuts to date, and $14 billion worth of spending cuts announced in previous budgets will take effect this fiscal year. One of the areas that's always something that Canadians are deeply concerned about is the issue of health care. On the line, we have Canadian Doctors for Medicare Chair, Dr. Monica Dutt. Good morning, Dr. Monica.
Good morning.
I don't know why I'm calling you Dr. Monica.
Monica's fine.
It's like we're one of the mainstream talk shows or something. With Dr. Monica. Anyway.
It has a ring to it.
Anyway, Monica, you, I know that that you have concerns around the fact that, healthcare wasn't truly addressed in the budget, and in fact, the budget itself creates increased inequality between provinces. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, the story is that there really is no story, in that they haven't mentioned healthcare at all in this budget. It's just something that it seems that the federal government decided they don't need to play a role in, which is strange given that we've had this health accord that should be up for renewal next month. And the health accord is essentially an agreement between the federal government and provinces to try to meet certain goals. And so we just really have no idea if those goals have been met. There's no desire to renew that accord. And so we're left with a state where there aren't national standards being set. And then the other aspect that you mentioned is the funding formula, which has changed. And which means that the transfers to provinces for every province except for Alberta will be less than it has been in the past, and that's definitely going to impact the healthcare systems in all of our provinces.
Yeah, so what does that change in the funding formula look like? Because the news reports that I've seen say that it's a $4 billion increase to the transfer. The health transfers. So how can you have a $4 billion increase, yeah, and yet most provinces except Alberta be receiving less?
So the difference is in the way the formula is calculated for how much each province gets. So I know the numbers for Nova Scotia specifically, in that, yes, there will be, you know, money transferred, and it is $682 million, which is a higher amount, but then it's less than it would have been under the old formula. So it's more than $20 million less than we would have had,
Okay. Because
now it's based on population as opposed to any other factors such as income or demographics. So we have a population that has a province with a much younger demographic that will be getting more money, and that's not to say Alberta doesn't need the healthcare dollars. It's more just across the country. It's creating this inequity in terms of different provinces and how much they get because we don't take other factors into account anymore.
So it seems like the biggest thing is that is what's not being done. And I know that the Canadian Doctors for Medicare have some strong demands about what you think Canadians need in terms of improvements to our health system.
Sure. There's many different roles that the federal government should be taking on. So one of them is, in terms of federal legislation, we have the Canada Health Act, which is something that the government should be enforcing and upholding. And there's now numerous instances where they're not enforcing this act. And this is an act that ensures that Canadians do have access to care across the country and shouldn't have unequal care in different places. And as we know, that isn't happening. So the government could be playing a key role in actually enforcing the legislation that it's supposed to. And then on top of that, because it's our national government, they could be setting national standards, pushing for innovations in a way that is in partnership with the provinces. So a few things that we've specifically advocated for is a national pharmacare program, and we're the only country with a universal healthcare program that doesn't include medications or pharmaceuticals. So it makes sense economically. Mm-hmm. We know that it would save us money, but we also know it would benefit all Canadians. We know that pharmaceuticals is one of the most expensive parts of people's health care. Yeah. So,
and a lot of people with chronic health issues go without, without taking their medication simply because they can't afford to.
Yes, definitely. Lots of people don't have private coverage and they don't have other ways to cover it. And if they're not under, even in social assistance programs, often only cover certain medications. So you're still sometimes stuck if you have a government-funded program, much less the people who don't have any other coverage and aren't able to pay for medication. So yes, it's a significant issue.
Yeah. So I know that there's also, you're looking at some innovations in terms of reducing wait times.
Yeah, so right now we do have, different systems across the country, and there is some collaboration, and the premiers have definitely put effort into having some things replicated across the country, but without national leadership, it makes it difficult. So there are certain things, for example, in Alberta, the Bone and Joint Institute of Alberta, that has found a way to reduce wait times for hip and knee surgeries, which is something across the country people talk about that being a long wait list, and they've managed to do it. So why isn't that a system that the federal government can support to be in place in different provinces? And then another one is around specialist wait times, a system in Ottawa that's around e-consultation or electronic consultation. So it's a computerized system that allowed wait times for specialists to be decreased significantly. So these are the kind of things that would be really important to Canadians if we were able to implement them across the country.
Mm-hmm. It seems like one of the things that's happened over the years is that as healthcare, is defunded, and the Health Act, Canada Health Act, sort of ignored, just the fight for trying to retain what we have becomes mm-hmm. the focus, and talking about things like a national pharmacare strategy, or even something like having dental care included, just gets lost.
Yeah, definitely. I've worked in different roles from a frontline family physician to different levels of administration, and it's a struggle at every level trying to do more with less and less funding. So definitely it's something that through the years we're having to deal with more and more. And as you say, there's other things that do make financial sense too to be included. So dental care and home care and long-term care, those are other significant areas as we're trying to shift more care out of the hospital into the community. Is that being done in a way that truly benefits the health of the patient as well as the workers who are now often working in unregulated settings rather than, in hospital and other settings where they do have a bit more protection? So it's both, issues around patient care, issues mm-hmm. around how we hire and train and pay people who are giving community care. These are all areas that have national implications that the federal government as well as provincial governments need to be looking at.
Mm-hmm. And for those who say that we can't afford this, I wonder if you have any thoughts in terms of what the cost of not taking action in these areas, both economically and socially, are.
Yeah, I think there's a few things there. People often talk about the healthcare system not being sustainable, but it's actually that the healthcare system has been fairly stable in terms of how much we're spending on it over time. It's just our overall revenue, for example, money we might get from taxes and other areas, has been decreasing. So as governments move into we don't want to tax anybody, we also lose services with that. So the healthcare spending formula has actually stayed fairly constant mm-hmm. over time. But there's a sustainability mm-hmm. side of it that you know, that's one myth around it. But, you know, looking at the bigger picture, I'm involved in public health work, mm-hmm. too, and that's also the preventive side. And we yeah. really do need to see that in a continuum, because it is much more than just the emergency services and acute care services in terms of what benefits our health. And I think that's really important to be looking at that whole mm-hmm. spectrum of what makes us healthy, in addition to the doctors and the nurses and the hospitals.
Yeah, well, thanks so much. We should wind up there, and I appreciate you joining us and the work that you do.
Okay, thank you for having me.
All right, thanks so much.
Okay, bye.
And that was Dr. Monica Dutt, Chair of Canadian Doctors for Medicare, interviewed by Jane Bowie in our program on February 12th. We'll be hearing directly from Ian Campo of A Tribe Called Red about their upcoming tour across the country, and we'll make sure we give you those tour days. Fresh off their double nomination for two different Junos this month, Tribe Called Red is embarking on a countrywide tour. Here's a few of their dates. Winnipeg on February 16th, Regina on the 18th, Saskatoon on the 19th, Calgary on the 20th, Vancouver on the 21st and 22nd, Victoria on the 26th, and Ottawa on March 1st, Toronto on March 7th. It keeps going. There's even more concerts in Kingston and Cumberland and a few other places, of course, in the States as well. Well, we reached them on the road in Ontario, driving to a gig, and I spoke to DJ Endian, also known as Ian Campo, about their Juno nominations as well as the upcoming tour, and we'll again give you those dates, or you can go to atribecalledred.com to find out when those tour dates are. Here's Ian Campo, interviewed on our program on Thursday. You're listening to Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. You can find us online at w2media.ca. We've been playing tons of A Tribe Called Red today, going right back to their first album. On the line, we have Tribe Called Red DJ NDN, Ian Campo, and I believe he's in a car with Bear Witness. Is that true?
That is true. That's right.
How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Cool. Thanks for joining us. And where are you driving right now?
We're on our way to Kitchener, Ontario, to do some interviews, and then after that, we're going to London to play a show tonight.
Oh, fantastic. You got two shows coming up here in Vancouver on February 21st and 22nd at the Commodore. Have you been to this venue before? I think it's one of the best venues in town. It's a great place.
No, I haven't been to that venue yet, but from what I've been hearing and its reputation, it's definitely one of the best rooms in Canada. I've been told by all kinds of people that have played there.
Yeah, it's actually like a real ballroom. Like, it actually is. The Commodore Ballroom is well-named. Now, you usually play at Fortune Sound when you're here, which obviously is a legendary sound system, but you're growing, because the Commodore is a significantly larger venue, and now there's two dates on because the first one sold out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super exciting.
Why do people love you in Vancouver so much?
Oh, I'm not sure. We love Vancouver. We definitely love Vancouver. And, you know, it's always a real nice welcome when we get there. And we have a lot of friends out there, too, that we never get to see. So it's always a lot of fun to make our way out west, for sure.
Fantastic. Well, we've been giving away tickets to your concert here on the show. Could you talk about your two Juno nominations? That's pretty exciting. And I believe they're your first, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's another very extremely exciting moment in our careers. But yeah, it's awesome. We can't be more excited.
It's interesting. I was reading an article, and I noticed that you did not enter the Aboriginal category. I wonder if you could talk about that decision, because obviously for a lot of Indigenous artists, that's a key way of getting their music out. But why did you decide that you decided to go not for that category?
Well, it was a discussion, and it was a conscious decision to not apply for that for that award, only because we felt that we wanted to be in, competition or direct a competition with other music that is of the same genre, as opposed to, you know, being put into a category because of our heritage. And, like, we didn't want to take anything, like, we don't want to take anything away from the Aboriginal Music Award. It's fantastic, but we just didn't think it was fair to choose which album's better between, say, you know, our album, Inez's album, or George Leach's album. They're all brilliant, and, like, you can't compare a hard rock album with an electronic album and tell me which one's the better album. You know what I mean? So we decided to opt out for applying for the Aboriginal category.
Oh, really interesting. Now, I think the first time that I met you was on DJ Shub's back porch south of Ottawa, and you got a little recording studio going on there. What's the process like when you mix your beats, when you come up with the traditional powwow music that you're mixing in with? How do you decide as a group how this is going to look? What does that process look like?
Well, it's changed a lot since the last time you saw us on Shub's back porch. But now we got to book a lot of studio time. For the next album, we're going to be doing a lot of collaboration with a lot of contemporary Native artists and non-Native artists. But it's going to be a lot of studio work in studio and recording live music and performances to remix and put together. So a lot of, you know, creating beats and ideas on the road on a laptop that we have that we tour with. And then when we get the ideas down and they're solid enough, we go into the studio.
Well, it's really fascinating process. You guys have spanned a lot of genres within the EDM or electronic dance music frame. You've had some dubstep beats in your first album. You've got some more mellow stuff. You've moved into kind of a trap terrain, a little harder sound. Mm-hmm. Where are you headed now? What's your next album going to look like, for instance?
We're
you mentioned collaborations, but like stylistically.
Yeah, it's we don't really know yet. It's all still developing, so we're still in the idea stages, and we really want to develop these songs that we're working with people with them. So it's going to be, again, a lot of studio work and stuff like that, as opposed to you know, just making the song and then being like, all right, this is how we want it to sound, and just put it out like that. Like, we actually want to work with the artists that we're working with to create a song together.
I think the way that you bring in the traditional music is really interesting and creates this interesting conversation in your music that, you know, a lot of successful Indigenous artists, they're very focused on message. It's like topical folk music or blues or rock, or a lot of hip hop in Canada, for instance. Most of the hip hop I love is Indigenous hip hop, like True Rez, Team Rez Official, Equal, Kenny Star. But what is it that, you know, that's unique about having dance music as your method? I mean, it's, I remember we talked before about how, you know, there aren't many club nights, for instance, or house parties that you'd find, you know, Indigenous music or for Indigenous people.
Right. I think what sets us apart from a lot of, you know, rap and blues and country, that's another big genre that First Nation people tend to gravitate toward, is that all of those styles of music come from a place of, you know, anger and sadness and despair. Like, blues, country, and hip-hop are very, very, you know, real, true struggle music. Whereas, like, dance music, it's about dancing, and it's about being happy, typically. And it's about, you know, dancing. And it's really funny because that sort of attitude, married with, like, the idea of powwow kind of, you know, was juxtaposed really well, where powwow is about dancing and being happy and meeting new people and, you know, hanging out with old friends and that sort of thing. So when we first launched our electric powwow parties, we were really excited that was the kind of feel to our parties that we had.
So you're heading out here. You're on tour as well. I believe you're playing a few stops along the way. What's the experience like on the road with you guys? I mean, you guys must have a great time. You're always having a party when I'm with you. So it seems like you guys make fun of each other a lot, mostly.
Yeah. You know, the camaraderie is next level, I'd say. You know, we've been on the tour. I've seen these guys more than I've seen my family last year, you know, on tour and stuff. We were home for 3 months out of 12 and on the road for 9 of it. But, yeah, it's good. It's really good. The road is awesome.
The road, we already played that one. It was our first track today, but that was an Idle No More track. And I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about your own personal activism. You've successfully, apparently, on a football team naming streak, you nailed down the Nepean Redskins. Could you talk a little bit about the attention that brought? And I mean, what drives you in terms of, that seemed like an unwinnable battle, and it seems like they actually backed down and changed the name. So what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I'm ecstatic. That's been a 3-year protest that ended on a great note, and it's redeeming. It's finally people are talking about different issues that need to be talked about, and you know the native non-native relationship needs to be discussed. Like, we need to start talking about it, and it seems that social media, at least, is making it so that we're able to have these conversations and discuss why using, you know, terms like Redskins for youth football is inappropriate, and why, you know, wearing headdresses to concerts and stuff is inappropriate, and you know, that sort of thing. So it's good. It's really exciting.
Well, congratulations on that, and we're really excited to see you out here on February 21st and 22nd, Ian.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
I wanted to close, I noticed that there's a song by Angel Hayes that mixes some of your beats, and it's actually called A Tribe Called Red. Maybe we're going to end on that note, but could you talk about how you got to working with her, what that was like, your thoughts on the song?
Yeah, Angel is Cherokee. She's half Cherokee, and she reached out on Twitter, and we just started talking on Twitter, and she asked us to send her a beat, and we did, and that ended up being the beat on the on the album. And at the same time, the producer of her album is also, we met earlier through mutual friends, so it kind of just all worked together pretty well. It was pretty serendipitous.
Well, it's amazing, a Twitter collaboration.
Yeah, pretty much.
Hey,
I
usually just crap on Twitter, so here we go. You've actually got some, here's some beautiful stuff that's come out of it. Thanks so much for joining us, Ian. See you when you're out here.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Thanks so much.
Take care, though.
That was DJ Endian from A Tribe Called Red, just nominated for 2 Juno Awards, and check us out at w2media.ca. You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, as well as at w2media.ca/thisweek. You can also find us on Rabble Podcast Network and on iTunes, as well as CHLY Radio in Nanaimo. Our final interview for today, Jahanzeb Hussain, the guest host at Friday's shows, interviewed 2 Toronto activists bringing attention to civilian deaths in Afghanistan using sports. We'll hear that interview now, produced by Jahanzeb Hussain on February 7th.
We have on the line 2 guests from Toronto, Samira Sayed Rahman and Riaz Sayani Mulji, both of whom who created a faux website for Toronto Maple Leafs. And on it, they issued a press release which said both Canadian soldiers and innocent civilians killed in the war in Afghanistan will be honored in this week's annual Forces Appreciation Night. And Samira is a student at McMaster's, and anti-war activist and a member of Afghans United for Peace, while Riaz is the co-founder of Sports Without War and a youth worker from Hamilton, Ontario, and will be pursuing his JD in the University of Toronto Faculty of Law come this September. Thank you, both of you, for being on the show with us.
Thank you for having us, John.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so I want to start asking Samira, how did this idea about this fake press release come about?
Well, actually, the idea came about, it was originally Riaz's idea, so I think he might have a little more to say on that.
Okay, yeah, Riaz, go ahead.
Sure. I'm on a train right now to Montreal, and the idea actually came while I was on a train about a month ago, or a month and a half ago, to Montreal. Samir and I had done a lot of anti-war activism together over the past few years, and we had noticed that sometimes in this day and age, you need unconventional, novel ways of reaching people. And we had all heard of the Yes Men before and seen the different stunts or culture jams they had put on. So one stunt in particular that they did against the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was to hold a fake press release, to issue a fake press release and hold a fake press conference that got picked up by major media outlets about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce supporting environmental regulations that they had opposed for decades and decades. So given how successful that culture jam was, we thought, how great would it be if we could do something like that for Forces Appreciation Night and the pro-war messages being put out by the Toronto Maple Leafs in conjunction with the Department of Defense. So that's pretty much where the idea came from.
So why sports in particular? Because sports, as we know, plays a huge role in promoting Canadian nationalism. So is that one of the reasons why you would target Canada's most favorite activity?
Yeah, for sure. Like, sports, well, hockey is sacred in Canada, as we all know, but in particular, Forces Appreciation Night is a pretty new thing. Like, it's only been around since 2006. And that was created by a partnership with a general in the Canadian military and a CEO, actually, I think at the time, president of Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, to do pro-war messaging, because the war in Afghanistan has been the most unpopular war in Canada. Like, more than 80% of people opposed the war, and it had been going on already for about 5 years at that time, and it's just been getting steadily more unpopular. So I think we went after it because it is one of those avenues that the government had been branching out into to try to keep up support for the war, and to be quite frank, was reaching a lot of people. It didn't help that Don Cherry on Hockey Night in Canada was doing just as bad a job in keeping support for the war going on his end. So we knew there needed to be some sort of action taken.
And Samira, what has been the response to this press release?
So the response has been relatively great. Everyone along the political spectrum, I've had quite a bit of people sharing it on either side, whether they are, you know, usually pro-war or involved in the anti-war movement. What we found with this press release is that it really garnered the attraction of the average Canadian hockey viewer. Because it's something that you can't, you know, really resist. It's something that everybody can put themselves behind. All the press release was calling for was, you know, to treat Afghan lives the same way that we treat Canadian lives, that there is no difference in the worth of the two. So the response has been pretty great, especially now that once we claimed responsibility for it, I think we've been able to get quite more attention out of creating this fund. So.
And how long did it take people to realize that it wasn't actually the real Maple Leafs website?
Well, some people didn't realize until, you know, recently when we actually claimed responsibility for it. A lot of folks within the sports community realized that it may be a hoax, given that you couldn't find official press, like official releases from the Maple Leafs website, and other sports outlets were not reporting on it. So that's when sports commentators began to realize that this may be a little bit of a hoax, but everyone else tended to believe that it was real.
And I wanted to ask, like, as a woman, how important is it to challenge this very masculine sport? Because you're an Afghan woman, and hockey is a very white male dominant sport in Canada. So how important is it to challenge these kind of sports?
I think it's quite important. Again, like you're saying, it is a male-dominated world, the world of sports has been historically. And especially with regards to Troops Appreciation Night, they've often used the woman as some sort of a symbol. In the past, during sports, I think I remember last year, we had, you know, female soldiers propelling from the rafters as, like, some rode in on tanks across the ice to try to portray this image of, you know, the liberated white woman in contrast to the oppressed Afghan who this war is there to liberate. So that was kind of one of the main influences for me to try to get involved in this specific project. And as a woman, as an Afghan woman, I think it's extremely necessary for us to be speaking out and calling out not only the patriarchy that exists within the military, but also what's happening in the world of sports, specifically in hockey.
And Riaz, I wanted to ask, what role can sports play in activism and anti-war awareness in the country?
Yeah, so I think what the fake press release really demonstrated is that there's an audience for MLSC to do something like, you know, honor not just the sacrifice of the troops that, you know, decided to put their lives on the line, but also the Afghan civilians who were killed and to actually support the troops by bringing them home. And I think that's a clear example of how sports can be used in a positive way in terms of creating more peace and just society.
And going on, you are founder of Sports Without War. Are you going to be doing much more, any more projects similar to this one?
Yeah, so Sports Without War started about a year ago, and it was in response to this creeping militarism we were seeing in professional sports, but not just at the professional level. Even if you go into a college or university campus, you'll see partnerships with the Canadian Forces and varsity sports teams. So we knew that there needs to be something done. I think the whole point of our culture jam was to shift culture, and that's all about.
And right now, the Sochi Olympics are happening in Russia, and there's a lot of homo nationalism and a lot of nationalism coming out of Canada. So I wanted to ask Samira, what role is these kind of events, these mega events, playing in this cultural manipulation which Canadian state uses in extending its militaristic foreign policy and its moral stance in the world, not just in Afghanistan but in other places as well?
I think it plays a significant role. I mean, if we do look at not just the Sochi Olympics but other sporting events that have taken place over the course of the past 10 to 12 years, specifically since Canada's increased military involvement.
I think that's his train arriving in Montreal or something. But yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I got distracted. I thought you were speaking to me.
No, go ahead.
I think it does play a significant role in the way that Canada does portray itself. With regards to hockey, I mean, it is the Canadian pastime. It is something that is sacred, like Riaz was saying. And it's ridiculous to see that the government is now using that as a tool of recruitment and as a tool of further militarizing the society. And the same can be seen when we talk about the Sochi Olympics or other sporting events internationally. The government continues to use sports as a tool of spreading a certain agenda. And that is highly problematic and needs to continually be called out.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us on your show.
All right, thanks. That was Samira Sayed-Rahman and Riaz Sayani-Mulji.
And that was hosted by Jahanzeb Hussein on our program last Friday. Thanks, Jahanzeb, for a great segment that links in the Olympics, too. Well, that's our show for this week, Democracy North. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, you can find us at w2media.ca/thisweek. I'm David Ball. Have a great week.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
I've continued to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at W2Media.ca.